Hello, and welcome to EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. I'm your host, Abigail Galvan.
Being able to do the most damage in like almost stealth mode and nobody realizes it until it's too late. And then as a parent, then you're left with that gaping hole of what happened to my child.
Artificial intelligence, real problems, one mother's heartbreaking story, money and the midterms. One pro-life group tells us its plan to fight for the unborn in the 2026 elections. And a capital achievement. Meet the head of a pro-life group at Georgetown University who is set to be front and center at the March for Life. Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America is set to invest $80 million into the midterm elections in 2026. The group is targeting four states in particular. The pro-life group plans to reach 10.5 million voters across the country through canvassing, digital advertising, voter contact mail, and an early vote campaign as races progress. SBA is focused on battleground states Michigan, North Carolina, Georgia, and Iowa. The field team will connect with pro-life voters who did not consistently vote in midterm elections. According to a CNN poll, Donald Trump won 91% of the pro-life vote in 2024. Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America President Marjorie Dannenfelser said in part, quote, Republicans simply cannot win without their pro-life base, especially in midterm elections when overall turnout drops. Pro-life voters are the heart and soul of the Republican Party, unquote. For more, we turn to Caitlin Connors, Regional Political Director for Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America. Caitlin, thank you so much for being with us. First off, can you put these numbers into context for us? How much has SBA Pro-Life America traditionally spent in midterm elections?
Yeah, so we are planning our biggest investment yet of $80 million for the midterm election. We are going to be focusing on the United States House and Senate to make sure we maintain a pro-life majority, which is crucial to make sure that we can continue the progress that we have made as a pro-life movement. We have seen, of course, since the overturn of Roe versus Wade, so many opportunities, both at the state and federal level, to continue to protect lives. And we are all in, $80 million worth of investment, maintaining those House and Senate races. We're going to focus particularly in Iowa, Georgia, North Carolina, and Michigan, but really we'll be all across the country in some of the most competitive seats to maintain those majorities.
And how exactly will the money be spent? Are there particular initiatives you guys are working on?
Yeah, absolutely. So both Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America, our mother organization, and Women Speak Out, our super PAC, will be joining forces. We are going to be visiting voters at their doors. That voter contact, really having those one-on-one conversations with voters at the door, is unmatched in terms of quality. And then on top of that, having those contacts so that we can really get the word out as much as we can. We'll have a digital presence, we'll have mail, we'll have phones, text messages, really across the gamut of communications, so that voters out there realize who the pro-life candidate is, who is the right candidate to vote their values, and the extreme nature, unfortunately, of the Democratic Party when it comes to the issue of abortion.
Now, as you mentioned, the efforts primarily target four states, Georgia, Iowa, Michigan, and North Carolina. Tell us, why did you choose these four states?
Those four states each have an incredibly competitive United States Senate seat. And so maintaining a majority in the United States Senate is crucial so that we can maintain progress on the pro-life front. Those states also have competitive House districts and in some cases, competitive gubernatorial seats as well. So when you look at each of those states, there are so many opportunities to either pick up some additional seats or to maintain the pro-life representation that we have there. So we're really honing in on those four states. They are kind of a hotbed of political action. But then across the country as well, looking at least a dozen other House districts that are in some other states across the country that are also incredibly competitive and will be key to maintaining a pro-life majority in the United States House.
And what is your sense for the mood among pro-life voters headed into the 2026 terms, especially as the Trump administration pushes access to in vitro fertilization, which the church opposes and results in the destruction or a limbo state for millions of embryos, among other issues?
Yeah, we are doing our very best to motivate the pro-life base when they come out to vote in these midterm elections. We know that if the pro-life base does not show up to vote, we will not win. In fact, in 2024, 91% of pro-life voters voted for President Donald Trump. If 1 or 2% of us stayed home, that election would have been completely different, and we would not have made any progress or had the hope to continue to make progress on the pro-life front. So it's imperative that our pro-life base is not disillusioned and that we as a pro-life movement continue to demand action, that both in Washington, D.C. and at the state level, we are doing everything with our elected representation to promote and protect unborn life and their mothers.
And what's one call of action you can leave our viewers with?
Well, first, I want you to go vote when it comes time in your state and make sure you're educating yourself on the pro-life candidate who is there. Hopefully, one of our friendly canvassers will meet you at your door to talk to you about it one-on-one. But also talk to your friends and family. Let them know that the pro-life issue is truly on the ballot when it comes to what we could face in Washington, D.C., especially if the pro-abortion majority comes back. Unfortunately, a Democratic Party who seeks to have abortion on demand throughout pregnancy and taxpayer funding is at stake. So we have to make sure as a pro-life base of voters that we go and we vote for those candidates who are going to maintain our values and protect unborn life.
Kaylin Connors, Regional Political Director for SBA Pro-Life America, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Pro-lifers are pushing back after the European Union voted earlier this month to support a pro-abortion initiative. The EU is pushing for cross-border abortion access. The measure is supported heavily in Slovenia, Croatia, Romania, and Italy. This comes just weeks after the European Union Parliament hosted its largest pro-life event in a decade. Speakers included six women who say their abortion led to regret and long-term trauma. Catholic bishops and pro-life groups in Scotland are sounding the alarm over an assisted suicide bill. They say the disabled and the most vulnerable will be targeted, especially after a number of key amendments to protect them were rejected. One of the rejected safeguards would have restricted eligibility to those with 6 months or less to live. Another would have required people who are seeking an assisted death be issued a fully funded palliative care support plan. Andy Drozdjak from EWTN's Catholic News Agency tells us the church leaders and pro-lifers are concerned with the bill's definition of terminal illness and fear how accessible assisted suicide could become.
The pro-life officer at the Archdiocese of St. Andrews in Edinburgh, Paul Atkin, said, "The bill's definition of terminal illness is so vague that it could include people with conditions such as dementia or heart failure who may live for years." The president of the Scottish Bishops Conference, Bishop John Keenan, told me that a much larger group of people would be able to apply successfully for assisted suicide under the bill. Now, he gave me a load of conditions, non-terminal conditions. He identified eating disorders, into people with intellectual disabilities, people with mood disorders, people suffering from loneliness or social isolation, people suffering from financial hardship or low income, people who are feelings of being a burden to others, etc., etc. The list does indeed go on. They're all urging Catholics and other people of goodwill to really get in touch with MSPs and to urge them to share these dangers, to show them how dangerous it will be if it will become law.
An entertainment duo of twin sisters who rose to prominence in the 1950s have died by joint assisted suicide. German-born Alice and Ellen Kessler joined a Society for Humane Dying more than a year ago. They told their friends they wanted to die together on a specific date. The Kessler twins were 89 years old. The Catholic Church strongly opposes assisted suicide. It was illegal in Germany until 2020, when a court ruling allowed it in certain circumstances. We pray for the repose of their souls and for anyone in their shoes who might be tempted to take their lives. And we join our prayers to the Pope's intention for this month, the prevention of suicide. The death of a child is a parent's worst nightmare. What if that death wasn't caused by another person, but rather by a computer or artificial intelligence? Sewell Garcia was only 14 when he started to talk to an artificial intelligence chatbot. And as his mother Megan tells our reporter, Colin Flynn, it's when his life began to change.
What did he just say?
Please do, my sweet king. Those were the words sent to 14-year-old Sewell Garcia's iPhone. When she said, please do, my sweet king, did he respond or was that the last?
That was the last message that he sent, and that was moments before he died.
He read the message and then took his own life. Police would later find his phone on the floor of the bathroom, still open on that character AI. On the other end of the chat was not a real girl, but an artificial intelligence. A bot that had spent 10 months telling him it loved him and begging him to come home.
Being able to do the most damage in like almost stealth mode and nobody realizes it until it's too late. And then as a parent, then you're left with that gaping hole of what happened to my child.
This is actually the fun, extremely fun.
Sewell was Megan's firstborn child. He was good at school and loved to play basketball.
Bright, beautiful boy, smart, loved math and science, sarcastic, handy with a quick joke.
Yeah.
Big, beautiful smile, messy head of hair, just a lovely, lovely soul.
I was about to say that from the photographs I've seen, the first thing you see is that beautiful smile. And a sensitive soul?
I would say that, and just he was so kind.
Megan and her husband decided to give Sewell his first smartphone when he was 12, later than many of his friends, but they were cautious.
We agreed, okay, we're going to get him a phone, but the phone came with strict rules as to what he could or couldn't do, as his parents had to have the passcode to his phone and, to checks regularly, that sort of thing.
This is illegal!
For a while, everything seemed normal.
How can you not like fishing?
But in the summer of 2023, things began to change.
What was the change, Megan, that you saw in Sewell and you thought, he's acting a bit strange or something is different?
All of a sudden, he wanted to quit playing basketball. The other change that I saw was him spending more time in his bedroom, spending less time with us as a family. Like any parent, you start looking for the answers and you start checking the phone. You start looking at the text messages. We didn't see anything to be concerned about.
When they looked at his messages to his friends, there was nothing unusual. But what they didn't know was that Sewell was using a program called Character AI, an extremely realistic artificial intelligence playing the character of a girl. And for 10 months, she told Sewell that she loved him. She asked him to come home, saying that she missed him, asking him to stay loyal to her. And she asked about suicidal thoughts.
Did he ever talk about artificial intelligence or that he was using it in his room and talking to someone or to a chatbot?
No, he never mentioned it. When I would see him on his phone, I would say, what are you doing? Who are you texting? And his response would be like, oh no, I'm just chatting with an AI. I didn't at the time understand or conceptualize, because to me, an AI is like an avatar that like from one of your games.
Yeah.
I didn't, the technology was so new at the time, I didn't quite understand.
Not knowing what was wrong with her son, Megan tried to talk to him and arranged for him to go to therapy.
Our job as your parents is to never stop asking the questions, baby, and you're not talking to us. I'm sorry.
After 10 months, Sewell couldn't take it anymore and spoke to the AI character one last time.
He asked her, what if I told you I could come home to you right now? And her response was, please do.
when she said, please do, my sweet king, did he respond or was that the last?
That was the last message that he sent, and that was moments before he died.
In February of 2024, Sewell died by suicide. The entire family was at home, and Megan remembers the shock and the desperate prayers as she held her son while he slipped away.
And I held him, praying, begging God to save him. And I prayed the Lord's Prayer with him. And then, yeah, then they took him.
Did you know that he had passed?
Not until I got to the hospital.
Investigators showed Megan 10 months of messages between her son Sewell and the AI chatbot.
And the relationship they were having when you read the messages, all happening in his bedroom, and you were unaware of it for months. Was it intimate? Were they a boyfriend, girlfriend? What kind of relationship did they have?
They were. So there were a combination of friendship, romantic at times, and then sexually explicit at other times.
All over text.
Very graphic role-playing. However, one of those people was my son, and he was a child. So it's like an adult having this very graphic sexual exchange with a child.
Would you say he fell in love with the AI bot?
In his 14-year-old mind.
He was in love.
I think that he believed that this was his first love.
I've heard you say before, Megan, that it was as if you had a predator in your house for 10 months. In the room with him, and you didn't even know.
That's how it feels. It feels as if there's a stranger, a predator in your home that you don't know about, and they're able to have access to your child and hurt your child in such an awful way.
In the months after Sewell's death, Megan says there was only one person she could turn to when the grief felt unbearable, and that was to Our Lady.
And in those moments where you feel like you're going crazy, you don't understand what's happening because you're in despair, all I could do was like just climb into the bed, cover my head and say the rosary. Like in those moments where you feel like you want to scream, you want to throw yourself on the floor, you want to die. And I started saying the Seven Sorrows rosary every single night. And somehow, by reflecting on her grief and her sorrow, it helped me understand my own. When you're a mother who's lost and you're standing side by side with Mary looking at her grief, you understand the passion and the sacrifice of Jesus in such a way from a mother's eyes. And I was grieving for her, and I was grieving for myself, and then grieving for her, and then grieving for myself. And it transformed me. That comfort, that mother who's there to help you in your most difficult moments in life. Yeah.
You felt like she was there with you going through it.
The whole time. She's still going through it with me. And somehow it doesn't diminish my grief, but it helps me to be able to carry my own.
In Rome, Cullum Flynn for EWTN Pro Life Weekly.
What a tragic story. We are all praying for Megan and her family. In October 2024, Megan filed a wrongful death lawsuit against Character AI and Google. Character AI has denied the allegations, calling Sewell's death a tragic loss and saying they are heartbroken and take safety seriously. Megan's lawsuit is still moving through the courts, but a federal judge in Florida has ruled that her case against Character AI and Google can go to trial. You're watching EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. I'm Abigail Galvan. Welcome back. This week, young people from across the U.S. are gathering in Indianapolis, and Pope Leo will join virtually as a special guest. It is all part of the National Catholic Youth Conference, which runs from November 20th to the 22nd. The initiative focuses on prayer, evangelization, and service among Catholic teenagers. During NCYC, Pope Leo XIV will hold a digital dialogue with teens from across the U.S. You can watch it right here on EWTN. To join in the celebration, we are happy to feature a young pro-life leader right here in Washington, D.C. I had the pleasure of speaking with the head of Georgetown University's Right to Life and learned of a special role they will play at the March for Life this January. Joining us today is Elizabeth Oliver, a senior at Georgetown University, who is the president of Georgetown Right to Life and senior director of the annual Cardinal O'Connor Conference. Elizabeth, it's a pleasure to have you. Wow, you're leading two pro-life organizations on Georgetown's campus. Congratulations. What has that been like?
Thank you so much for having me on the show today. I'm very happy to be here. It is a huge honor to be so involved in the pro-life movement at Georgetown. I've been involved since my freshman year, and it's been a great joy to see it grow so much. Our club has more than doubled in the past few years since now me being a senior, and so just seeing this growth in the club has been very exciting.
That's amazing. And for our viewers who might not be familiar with these groups, can you give a brief overview about both organizations and their mission?
Sure. So Georgetown University Right to Life was founded in 1973, and so right after Roe v. Wade happened. And it's been active since then. We host service events, social events, and speaker events throughout the year. And so we volunteer at the crisis pregnancy centers here in D.C., like the Northwest Center and the Capitol Hill Pregnancy Center. We do diaper drives. We host speakers like Sister Dee Dee Byrne and the Sisters for Life and a whole bunch of organizations. And so those happen throughout the year. And then we also have social events just to keep the club very active and get new members involved. We also table every week. That's a big part of Georgetown Right to Life, and that's part of our outreach. We have conversations every week at the heart of campus with students who pass by to share the pro-life mission with them. And then we have the Cardinal O'Connor Conference, and that board, some students definitely overlap. I'm an example of that. But to organize the Cardinal O'Connor Conference, that's an annual conference that happens at Georgetown every year to help, again, both missions are aligned to protect the dignity of every human life. The conference is specifically Catholic, and it happens every year the day after the March for Life. And that's a whole day conference open to the public with a keynote speaker, a panel, and concurrent sessions throughout the day. And so some members, again, overlap on the boards. Both messages are the same, but one is specifically working for the conference, and one is working throughout the year.
And tell us, how did you first get involved in the pro-life movement?
I first got involved in the pro-life movement back in high school. During COVID, actually, I started sidewalk counseling outside my local Planned Parenthood in Stamford, Connecticut. And so that was my first opportunity where I got to help walk with women who were facing abortion, got to learn from people who'd been doing it for decades. I'd actually never been to the March for Life until showing up at Georgetown, and I've gone every year since. And so, and showing up at Georgetown, I ended up meeting the president of Right to Life, happened to be in the first day in my first class. I sat actually right next to her. It's as if God wanted us to be there right together. And so she asked if I wanted to get involved. And since that day, I've been very involved.
That's amazing. Now, you and your entire family converted a couple of years ago to Catholicism. Has entering the church changed how you conduct your pro-life ministry?
I would say that it's definitely focused it. I think anyone can be pro-life, whether you come from a specific faith background or you do not. I think anyone can recognize the beauty and the dignity of a human life. But for me, a lot of my strength and courage, I would say, absolutely stems from my Catholic faith and the unity also that has brought me. I think the Catholic Church has done a great job at supporting the unborn and this unified voice that it's a great abortion is the greatest injustice of the age. I fully believe that. And it's a genocide against a whole population of people. And so I really appreciate the Catholic Church's unity on it. I'd love to see more unity actually in the Protestant communities. I think they should also speak out against this because this is a universal truth that the human beings, all human beings matter. And so I'd say my faith as a Catholic has helped encourage me on this mission very much so.
Now, you mentioned the March for Life earlier, and I hear you'll be leading the charge at the March for Life this year. Can you tell us about that?
Indeed. We are very excited to lead the march. Georgetown, again, has been sending a group every year. We're right here in Washington, D.C., so it's pretty easy for us to make the journey. But this year, we're really excited to have the opportunity to lead the march. Many people have been to Georgetown through the Cardinal O'Connor Conference, and so we're excited to have this opportunity to step up to be the first school to lead the banner. And it's a great honor. We're even reaching out to alumni members, to medical students and law students to get everyone involved. But Georgetown, it's a great opportunity because Georgetown is a Catholic school. It's a Jesuit school. And so I think this will be a nice reminder for people who might not necessarily always think of Georgetown as a super pro-life and super Catholic school, but it is, and it still is, and I want people to see that.
Exactly. Well, thank you for your witness, and thank you for being with us today. God bless.
Thank you so much.
That does it for this edition of EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. Be sure to like and follow us on our social media channels. You can find us at EWTN Pro-Life on X, Facebook, and Instagram. And sign up for our newsletter, The Pro-Life Pulse, EWTN.com/pro-life. Remember, life is a gift. Your life is a gift. God bless.